You're listening to Agile Ideas, the podcast, hosted by Fatima Ibuchi.
For anyone listening out there not having a good day, please know there is help out there. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Agile Ideas. I'm Fatima, CEO at Agile Management Office, Mental Health Ambassador, and your host. This podcast is sponsored by Agile Management Office, providing high-impact delivery execution in an agile era for scaling businesses. On today's episode, we have the lovely Karen Ferris. Karen is an internationally acclaimed author and speaker and thought leader. She provides strategic and practical advice and insights to many industries. She is a self-professed organizational change rebel with a cause, pushing boundaries of the profession and challenging traditional ways of thinking. In 2011, she authored a breakthrough publication, Balanced Diversity, A Portfolio Approach to Organizational Change, that introduced an innovative framework for ensuring that organizational changes become embedded into the core of organizations. Now she helps organizations thrive in the face of volatile, uncertain, and complex change by building resilient workforces, providing new tools and approaches for a new age in organizational change management. In 2019, she published her second book, Game On, Change is Constant, Tactics to When Change is Everyone's Business. This book explores how every organization can be fit, skilled, capable, supported, and well prepared for change. In this episode with Karen, we talk everything from change management, building resilience and what resilience means, what are the barriers to productive and constructive self-reflection, the importance of vulnerability, and how we incorporate change management techniques and methods into the work that she does as a mentor and a coach, as well as topics such as accountability and governance and agility. So please join me in welcoming Karen Ferris to the show. Welcome, Karen, to the show. Thanks so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure. I'm very excited to be here.
It's exciting because obviously we've known each other for a little while and there's quite a lot of things that we could talk about, but I wanted to spend a lot of time talking about change management because I think amongst the pandemic and where we are today, there's a lot of change and resilience needed. And so I was hoping we can touch on that. But I wanted to start off by just going back a little bit because I first met you and you gave me a copy of one of your early books, and it was all around IT service management. So I wanted to get people who are not familiar with what that is to understand a little bit more.
Cool. Yeah, so IT service management's all about, and it doesn't make me technical, I'm far from it, but IT service management is making sure that the processes that we use in IT are the most effective that they can be, so that the machine runs slowly, if you like, and is enabled, and technology is enabled to meet business needs and demands. So IT service management really is a bit like an engine room that supports the technologists and makes sure that, you know, everything, like I say, is running as smoothly as possible. So it's a set of processes as an approach, and there's lots of frameworks. ITIL is the most commonly widely used, and we've just seen the release of ITIL 4 last year, issue 4, I suppose. But things like from the start, so ITIL came out in the 1980s, and it was really a set of best practices. So the UK government had gone out and said, what are successful organisations doing in this space? And they wrote down what the best practices were at the time, and it's evolved since then over the decades. And as I say, it is probably the go-to place. But when it started, it was things like incident management. So when something breaks, how do we handle it? Well, we need to prioritize it. We need to understand who's the best person to fix it. So in a nutshell, so processes like that, how do we manage change? How do we understand what our configuration is? How do we have a service level with the business? So a whole set of processes that evolve and improve over time.
Okay, beautiful. And so, you know, I've obviously received your earlier book, and I know that you're rewriting that book at the moment. And I think it's ready. Is it currently ready?
Yeah, it's out.
It's gone. Beautiful, beautiful. And now, you know, going through and having a look through and reading that book, I can see that there's a strong emphasis on change management. And now, for most of the time that I've known you, you've been talking about the fact that change is constant. Can you tell me why you say change is constant?
I'll just take a step back. So I moved into the change space probably formally. I was always doing change management. I think we're all doing it, but we just don't call it that necessarily. Organizational change as opposed to IT change. And managing the people side of transition. So as a people leader or whatever, you're doing it anyway. So we're all the leaders of change. And 10 years ago, I was working in the IT service management space. And then I wrote that first book that you talked about called Balanced Diversity. And it was a framework for embedding change successfully into an organization. And because it was an organizational change book, it sort of, and I hate the word pivot, but it sort of shifted me into that space. And as we've going through now, whether it's, you know, we're in the era of constant change. It's our normal. We don't know when the next change is coming. It's unprecedented. It brings uncertainty, but it's driven by increased consumer, customer, constituent demand, disruptive technology. That disruption is just getting faster and faster. Things like robotics, AI, big data, edge computing, it's all sorts of stuff coming out that is going to keep disrupting us, whatever industry we're in, because every business is an IT business, really, these days. And it's not going to slow down anytime soon. So I do, as you know, Fatima, a lot of work around resilience, because we have to be able to absorb that amount of change. The organization cannot afford employees to resist change. They need to just embrace it and say, this is our norm. This is our life. And if the organization is going to survive, and if I'm going to have a job as an individual, then we need to embrace it.
When talking about resilience and change positivity, do you believe that an added focus on these can have a positive impact on the organizational competitiveness as well? Because as you said, change is constant, happening all the time. What's your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. If we create a workforce that's resilient in the face of constant change, i.e. they accept that that's the norm, and we all respond differently at all times. But if we have a workforce where we're giving them the resources, we're equipping them and supporting them on an ongoing basis, where they can adapt, flex, change direction rapidly, those are the organizations that are going to be ahead of the game. They're going to be ahead of the competition. They're also going to be ahead because when you're investing in your people, as you will know, you increase motivation, you increase their inspiration, you increase their productivity, which increases your profitability. And it's a no-brainer. Come on, you know, it's like and there's a lot of people talking about it, and I just wish we could see more people doing, but put people first. And it's the organizations that, and this pandemic is an example, there's a lot of people saying that the organizations have put people first and try to retain them, try to find them different roles, looked after them through this, are the ones that are going to come out ahead and stronger, as opposed to those that had the knee-jerk reaction and just said, I need to get rid of half of you because we're not going to survive, without due care and conversation taking place. So that'll be interesting to see as we do come out the other side of this, whether that's the case. I think it will be, because also people talk, you know, social media has its downs, but it's also one of the best platforms to say, you know, my boss is a bad boss, or this organization's toxic, or they just didn't look at us through this pandemic at all, didn't support us at all. And we go, really? I'm not going to work for them, or I'll avoid them, or I'm not going to buy from them. So the knock-on effect can be massive to brand and reputation.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because we've spoken to a few people that have shifted quite significantly their business model. So, you know, we spoke to Jeremy Fleming a few months ago that, you know, went from having one of the, you know, most popular event management businesses, and all the events were cancelled, and they shifted to end up making furniture, which now is like completely meant that they've kept their entire team employed. And as a small business, we've been fortunate to be able to keep our team together. But I think you're right. I think there is a lot of knee-jerk reactions that some companies have made, maybe not proactively, but rather reactively, that's probably going to cause a bit of pain moving forward. So I think it's really interesting, you know, the resilience side of it. I think, you know, coming from a background of mental health, I also do believe that if you build up resilience, that it can actually help you with your mental health. I've seen that firsthand personally. Do you think that the change resilience also becomes, you know, pair and pair with mental health, and how have you seen resilience, I guess, improve mental health from that perspective?
Absolutely, it does. It's core to mental well-being in the workplace. And it's not just about coping with change, it's about coping with any situation in an organisation. Mm-hmm. Change is happening faster and faster, and that has an, you know, knock-on effects. I've suddenly got to adopt new technology. I've got to work in a different way. I've got a different role now in the organisation, and I'm just now faced with a new challenge or a problem. How do I deal with all that and, you know, maintain my mental well-being? So part of, you know, resilience, and it's a word at the moment, unfortunately, that's bandied about, and I think it's lost its value and a meaning in a lot of ways. People see resilience as someone who's stoic and they've got the armour and they're never going to be knocked down, and that's not what it's about. Resilience. People do get knocked down. Resilient people have bad days. It's how they deal with it and how they look at it that's the difference between them and those people and other people. So if I have emotion intelligence, for example, that's part of being resilient, if I am self-aware, I know what my triggers are, I can deal with them. If I know how to reach out to other people and collaborate, if I know how to empathize, communicate and listen. And these are all, you know, to me, elements of being resilient and lots of other things as well that enable you to cope with the stresses and the anxieties and the challenges in your personal life as well as your work life. I think the unfortunate thing is, there's a lot of organizations say, oh, yeah, we do resilience. We did a workshop like 6 months ago. And I'm like, no, it's not a point in time that you tell people they need to be resilient and you gave them some tools and then you just, that's it. This has to be something that's there all the time, that people can reach out to the right resources, get the right support. It's about changing, and I'll use the word leadership, changing leadership so they can identify quickly the low signs of resilience and do something about it. I work with leadership, and you know that they're just scared to ask the question. So it's like saying, we know in Australia we've had the Are You Okay campaign, which I think is brilliant. We have all the posters. There's not many people say, are you okay? So it's like I could say, are you okay, Fatima? And you say, actually, Karen, I'm not. And I go, oh shit, now what do I do? And that's what people are scared of. And they think they have to have the answers. And I'm like, no, all Fatima wants is me to say, let's go and have a coffee. Let's talk. And give you the chance to talk and then help you find where to go for the right support. And then reach out tomorrow, how are you going? Reach out next week. Yeah. And it's like, when I say that's it, like, and I don't mean to, you know, that's it, but when leaders get that, and I see them when we have this conversation, they go, oh, okay. And they suddenly feel more comfortable in having that conversation. So resilience is, it's massive. It's about psychological safety. It's about vulnerability. It's about having the right conversations. It's about leaders doing that, reaching out and spotting, you know, if I notice, I'll give you an example. I did some work for the ATO, and the lady I was working for at the time, I was doing a change role, and I just sensed, and it was an email, and I just sensed something. And the next time I was on the phone, and again, I could just sense in the tone, I couldn't see her we weren't on, you know, collaboration or Zoom or anything like that. It was just a telephone. And I just said, I won't use a name. I just said, are you okay? And there was this silence. And she broke down, and she'd had been something, you know, quite drastic in her home life. And just, yeah, and just let it all out. And it was like, whoa, you know. And I knew I didn't have the answers, but I just wanted to reach out and say, yeah, are you okay? And it just made all the difference that she felt she could share, and then the edge was off. That then, you know, she knew that I understood that she might be a bit short. You know, she was responding to me as if, you've got no idea, Karen. You know, I could feel that sort of, yeah, me saying, where's this document or something? In the scheme of things, she was like, who cares, you know? So yeah, we all need to be able to spot change in language, change behaviour, demeanour, work, all those little things we just need to pick up and be prepared to say, are you okay? They might say, yeah, I'm actually fine. And that might be the truth. So,
I think there's a lot to unpack there. And one of the things that, you know, comes to mind, as you mentioned with that lady, that manager, for example, you often don't know what is going on. Everybody has their own, you know, demons, their own challenges and hurdles, whatever they may be. It may look like a picture perfect life on the outside, but definitely not. And so I think it's important to always, you know, go in with that sort of empathy that there may be some things going on. If someone is being short, just to kind of try and understand. The other thing I wanted to sort of touch on that you said is around, you know, asking the question, are you okay? And then having a response of someone starting to speak up and talk about what's going on doesn't necessarily mean that you as an individual has to have the answers to those problems. The fact that you're listening is what's incredibly powerful. And, you know, listening to someone, and knowing myself with a history of mental health in the anxiety space, just having someone listen to you can make all the difference. And like you said, you might just say, look, can I check in with you in a couple of weeks or in a couple of days? And just, yeah, just, you know, even if it's just listening and maybe giving them a link to, you know, the Beyond Blue or SANE or one of those organizations, sometimes is just sufficient. So it's incredibly powerful, and you don't have to have all the answers. So I think you're spot on with that. You touched on resilience and leadership. I want to know what, if anything, do you think is different between resilience in leaders compared to resilience in just everyday individuals? Do you think there's a difference, or do you think it's similar?
As you know, Fatima, I wrote two books this year called Unleash the Resiliator Within. One was for individuals, and that was everybody, regardless of position, regardless of role. So it talks about, you know, having emotional intelligence, being self-aware, collaboration, problem solving. So the Resiliator has 20 superpowers. So there's 20 things in that book, in the handbook, that they can pull on as they need, not all 20, just one or two, to build their superpowers to be resilient. And as I wrote it, one of the things I said, so there's a superpower called, you know, the empathizer, the collaborator, the communicator, the adapter. And the adapter is... there is an adapter being adapted, the revealer. And the revealer is the superpower that says, when you go to work or whenever, be your authentic self. Do not be someone you think other people want you to be, because there's nothing more fatiguing and exhausting than doing that. And that will reduce your resilience. So that's one of the things. And as I wrote about that, and I thought, so it's like me saying, so Fatima, next time you go to that meeting, if you don't agree with what's been said or don't understand, ask the question. And then tomorrow you say, Karen, that didn't go too well. And you know, they told me I shouldn't be challenging, I shouldn't be asking, whatever. So I thought, yes. So as well as superpowers and resilience for everybody, including leaders, there's also a handbook of 20 superpowers in particular for leadership. So they have both books, if you like, that they have to create that environment of psychological safety where someone can be their authentic self. So there's, and they have to be the identifier, as we mentioned, identifying the early signs. They have to be the caretaker and look after their people and support them and be there to remove obstacles as needed. And lots of other things. So there's things that leaders need to do to create an environment in which resilience, their own resilience and that of their teams and their people, can actually thrive.
Okay. I think it'd be really interesting for those people that are listening to actually take a look at those books, because I think the way that you have simplified it with, you know, really making it more of a engaging, fun, you know, as opposed to just, you know, loads and loads and loads and loads of text is definitely really positive. I think it'll resonate with a lot of people. You mentioned, well, you're a self-obsessed, you're obsessed with the people side of change. So you say that all the time. So I want to ask a couple of questions. One, what does that mean for those that are listening? And what do you think are the greatest challenges to getting people to change?
Okay, great question. You know, we're throwing change at people all the time, and we have to be cognizant of what that means to people. You know, it causes anxiety, it causes stress, it causes fatigue, and it can just escalate if we don't look after the people side of change. So that's why I'm obsessed about it, because I care about, you know, I care about people, if you like, and looking after them and enabling them to be the best they can be. And I think that should be every leader's objective. Unfortunately, it's not always, but it should be. So that's where the passion comes from, if you like. And I think what we get wrong in organizational change management, which is the worst title we could have ever given this role, if you like, people think you're moving chairs around and building offices and all sorts of stuff. Organizational change management is about looking after the people side of change, helping people traverse and come out successfully and adopt change. What we tend to do, as if we're driving change, is we start talking to people about what we need to do and how we're going to do it. And we forget to talk about the why, because we've already thought about the why in our heads. So we're going, oh, yeah, we need to do this. Mm-hmm. And then we say, this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to do it. So I use the analogy of, you know, you could say to me, Karen, tomorrow we're driving to Sydney and I'll drive. So you've told me what we're doing and how we're going to do it. I've got no idea why we're going. So I'm not going to get in the car. I'm not going to get on board with that change. You know, we forget about the why. And it's like, if you look at the example of the pandemic, we asked people to make the biggest change they've probably made in their working lives and their home lives ever. We said, tomorrow you're working from home, you're using new technology, new software, and they did it. Generally, they made the best of it they could. Why? Yeah. Because they knew the why.
Yeah.
This was a matter of life and death. Mm-hmm. So they didn't question it. They didn't say, oh, I'm going to have to work out of the laundry, or I don't have a desk. Or, I mean, they probably thought those things, but they still just got on with it and made the best they could, because the why was just known. And that's what we forget mostly with change. Because if people get the why, and it makes sense, of course, it's a why that makes sense. Like the why is, if we don't do this, the business will fail because the competitors will be ahead of us. Mm-hmm. The why for me then is, I get that. And the what's in it for me is my job.
Yeah.
No-brainer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If the organization needs to survive, if we need to be ahead of the competition, if we need to adopt the latest technology because the whys, then most people will be on board. So I often say we need to stop talking about resistance to change and talk about resilience in the face of it. Because if we think we'll have to manage resistance to every change that's underway, it ain't going to happen. So we need to help people be resilient and not resist it, and get the engagement and the communication right about why we need to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that, you know, really frustrates me is every organization almost that, you know, I end up working in or have been part of, they're always harping on about change fatigue, change fatigue, change fatigue. And I think it plays to your point. I think that people are being told to change, but not being told why. It's like there's like this non-transparency veil that a lot of organizations put up. It's a big thing happening in the top floor boardrooms and nobody gets to know the reasons why. They're eventually going to find out. So if you bring them on that journey, then they're more likely to change. And we saw that case in point recently with some work we were doing, where we found that the people, there was over a third of the department within this supermarket that actually came on board that journey. They made the changes, but they knew why they were doing them, and collectively it actually brought about a, you know, an improved culture and engagement. So I think you're spot on. I think you're spot on with that. You wrote an article recently on self-awareness, and it was about saying that it's one of the most important capabilities for leaders to develop. What are some of the good methods or techniques or tricks or tools that you can help to share that may give leaders an opportunity to increase their introspection and their self-reflection to effectively be more self-aware?
I think it's something everybody needs, leaders as well, but everybody, we need to have that self-awareness. And I'll refer to the Daniel Goleman work, Google Daniel Goleman and emotional intelligence. And firstly, it's about that ability to be self-aware of what triggers your emotions, what makes you stressed. And when you reflect and realize what those things are, you can then start to manage them. You know, if it's a particular, so this is from like an individual thing, if there's a particular meeting you go to that absolutely gets you so wound up, if you understand why it is it a particular person, is it the fact that the meeting goes on twice as long as it should? And I'm using simple examples, but when you know what that is, you're preparing yourself for it and you can manage it. So the self-awareness and then being able to manage those emotions. You can't manage what you don't know. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of other things about emotional intelligence as well. It helps you not only be aware of yourself, but aware of other people's emotions. And I think it's really important. And for leaders, it's absolutely imperative that they recognize their strengths and weaknesses and have the courage to be vulnerable. People see vulnerability as a weakness. It's a sign of courage to say, I know what I'm good at, but I know I'm not so good in these areas. And to absolutely say that, which is why you have teams. You have teams of people who do things better than you can, and that's the strength of a team. And often we get, and I'll use, air quotes, leaders, managers, bosses, who think they have to have all the answers. You don't. That's not the role.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right. I mean, I follow a lot of, entrepreneurs like, Sir Richard Branson and others, and they talk about hiring people that are smarter and better than you. And that's the reason you have the team, so that they can effectively all lift each other up. So I think some people tend to have, biases that maybe it's hard for them to sometimes overcome. How do we overcome biases, more specifically to be able to admit that sometimes we have been wrong about something, which I think is a challenge for some people?
It is, and it's having the courage to do that, to say, look, I got this wrong, and this was what I did about it. And this comes down to being about vulnerability as well. But embracing the fact that when we are having change that's as constant as it is, we will have setbacks. I don't like the word failure, but we will have setbacks. Things will go wrong. That's the nature of the game. And if, as a leader, I can say, or a boss, I can say, do you know I got it wrong? Or I tried this and it didn't work. You suddenly generate a whole environment where people are going to share when things went wrong as a team or as an individual. And, this all comes down to the work of just gone out of my mind. But, that's psychological safety. Amy Edmondson, who her research, many years ago said she looked at successful teams and found that they weren't making less mistakes than other people. They were actually making more mistakes, but talking about them. And the Project Aristotle at Google found exactly the same thing, that the successful teams were the ones that were talking about mistakes and sharing them and learning from them, not pushing them under carpet and hiding them, or if it's fine. They were actually tabling them and saying, what did we learn? And that's why I like the word setback as opposed to failure. Yep, we've had a setback. That's what innovation's about. That's what experimentation's about. Yeah. And it's like, I don't know who said it, but if you're not making mistakes, you're not trying hard enough.
Yeah.
And I think that's,
It's interesting because that speaks to agile as well, which is a big, area of interest, as you know, of mine. And it's about that experimentation. It's about those lessons. It's about getting real feedback. It's about pivoting and changing and adapting and moving and all that sort of stuff. I find it really interesting, like in the governance space, which is sort of the background where I'm from. We talk about, I'll use the term PMO, but there's a lot of other names for it. And we've seen quite a interesting shift now with Agile and PMO. Have you seen something similar with Agile and change management? How do you see, or what have you been hearing around how people are trying to bring the two together, or maybe change management to have more of an Agile flavor? Have you seen a little bit of that in your work?
I think there's a couple of aspects there to think. Yeah, I think a lot of organizations, you will have seen this, this is your space more than mine, but organizations saying we need to, you know, do Agile. And I'm like, you can't do it, it's not an M. that's me on my soap. But they're saying, this is it's a new shiny thing, we need to do it. But then they don't have that mentality or mindset that says, we will embrace failure, we will have incremental improvement, we'll do things in bite-sized pieces, good is good enough, you know. It's like every time we get a new operating system on our phones, you know, we will get updates quite regularly initially because they're doing all the bug fixes. It was good, was good enough to get it out, you know, minimal viable product and all that sort of thing. So I think if people are going to, organizations are going to truly become more agile in the way they do things, there's a massive mindset shift that needs to happen first. Unless that happens, it's not going to. The other part of that question, does change management need to shift to work in an agile world? Absolutely. And I think this is the fundamental issue that the organizational change management profession is grappling with at the moment, even in just the constant change being faster. Most of us, including me, when we did our certifications or training way back when, went through this structured approach to change where you prepare for it, you manage it, and then you make sure it's reinforced and embedded. And then you take a breath and sit back because we've got some stability. No, we haven't. There is no stability anymore. And we were equipped with these laborious, if you like. It was great at the time. But, you know, if I've got to write a change strategy, a plan, a comms plan, a training plan, a reinforcement plan, sponsor roadmap, stakeholder engagement plan, and then I say to you, Fatima, I'm ready now. You're like, Karen, the project left the building. It's gone. We've done it. So change management has to become agile itself. And it becomes about working at the cadence of the agile change or the agile project. It's about plans on a page. It's about good is good enough. It's like having, you know, scorecards and blast radius and a lot of different tools that we now need to use to be able to operate that cadence. And that's a big shift in the thinking and the way of working for a lot of people. But it's absolutely got to fundamentally shift. And some of it is, there's a lot of people now talking about agile change, which is great. Yeah. I just think the practitioners really need to adopt that thinking and get on board.
Yeah, absolutely. And applying some of the principles of agile to change, to put them into change management, as opposed to, you know, the other way. I think one of the things that's been really interesting is I've not really seen in most of my sort of career, I've not really seen many people that are ever really trained in change management. So where we're talking about really large businesses, you've got project managers that maybe are not, for example, they're in a department, they don't have a lot of change managers. Typically, we see the larger organizations have change management. Medium-sized organizations tend to not even know the mention of that word. And so you see a lot of project managers and even some PMOs and other resources having to learn or actually apply change management, but not have any real training or skills or anything like that whatsoever, unless they've gone and done the courses and the certifications and whatnot. So I guess what I'm interested to know, is there any sort of techniques or methods, things that you would recommend for someone with really not much change management experience, practical experience, that you would recommend, whether they're a small business or a medium business or just someone that's looking to get more into change? What would you say to focus on? What would be a couple of things to focus on?
I mean, I think, you know, the certifications have their place to pay, but that's not what was going to get you to do change. So a lot of us had to do them because people look for them and say, oh, are you certified in this? And you're like, no. And they go, right, we're not engaging you. You know, it's okay, I'll do the certification. It's a means to an end. But really, I think for anybody, and I say, you know, change is everyone's business. Whether you're a project manager, an individual, it changes everyone's business these days. And I think what we need to do is, if we do have the change professional in the organization, whether it be one person or two people, I say now they have to stop doing and they start enabling. So they start teaching and coaching everyone in the organization, and start with the priorities, with the program managers, the project managers, and teach them about change. So I use an analogy, which you've probably heard before, and I use a soccer analogy because, as you can see behind me, there's a flag that's Liverpool Football Club.
It's Liverpool, so it's okay.
Sorry?
It's Liverpool, so that's okay.
Yeah. But I use the analogy of think of a soccer team or any team. Every game they play is different. The mm-hmm. weather, the location, the pitch, the supporters, the opposition, the tactics, everything changes. Even during the game, it changes. They change positions, someone gets sent off. They don't resist that change. They say, game on. That's the workforce we want. They are driving lead change while they're playing the game. We've got the managers who are our current change professional, the mm-hmm. OCM. And as I say, they've got to stop getting on the pitch, get off it, and strategize mm-hmm. about how do we make sure that that team, our workforce, are fit to play the game mm-hmm. and be resilient in the face of it. So that's where we have the role of the coaches. Now, often we talk about a change network or a team of change champions who are there to help everybody through change. So these could be project leaders, they could be managers, they could be execs. Anyone can be a change agent, if you like. We call them all sorts of different things. But often, if not, most times I go into an organization and they say, oh, we've got a change network. The only thing they've ever done with that change network is give them a lanyard that says, I'm a change network person or a change champion. They haven't mm-hmm. trained them. They haven't enabled mm-hmm. them. And they flounder and it just disappears, you know, and it was it's harder to affect the next time because the last time was a bit of a failure. So if we truly enable a team of what I call the coaches mm-hmm. across every level of the organization to teach them about what change is about, and it's not rocket science, it's about getting people to understand the why we need to change. What mm-hmm. is it they need? Talk to them, listen to them, engage with them. Who are the people immediately impacted? Who are interested in what's going on? Who can influence the outcome of this change? And those people doing change will recognize some of that language. You know, it's about stakeholders and knowing who they are and how they're going to be impacted and all the moving parts that are taking place. It's not rocket science. It's having stuff in place to help people on that journey. Hearing what they're saying, you know, identifying what the gaps are, filling the gap. Is it more training? Is it more coaching? Is it more awareness? And making that happen. And our coaches across the organization continually do that. It's not a full-time job. It's part of the job they have. There has to be commitment to make that happen. But then they can, if the project manager is not the change coach, they can have a change coach alongside them that will be on the project and make sure that everything's in position. And the coach liaises between the manager, mm-hmm. the change professionals, and the players to make sure that they're fit to play the game. They have everything they need, the practice, mm-hmm. the resources, the knowledge, whatever it might be. And I think when we truly do that, that's when change becomes everyone's business. We can support project managers. We can talk about what changes. We can make them the change coach and know that they've got support from the center of excellence, if you like, in organizations. And we can do that for, you know, small and, you know, small, medium organizations as well. So having a conversation about what change, how you transition people through change. You know, it could be a team of, I've talked to, there's a guy in New Zealand I had a conversation with recently who works with small businesses, and it could be, you know, a company of painters and decorators, and mm-hmm. he says, do they need to have to understand change? Absolutely they do. You know, they could change the payroll system, they could change the timesheeting system, they could change the way they allocate people to jobs, mm-hmm. and painters and decorators need to know why we're doing that. And they go, yeah, cool, I get that. Or we're using some automation, we're suddenly automating some way we used to do a job. So yes, they need to get everybody on board that change as quickly as possible. And it's really having conversations and engaging people.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you touched on the fact that, you know, managers sometimes are actually on the soccer field or on the sports field, and that's actually not a good place for them to be. They should be strategizing. Do you think that sometimes they're on the soccer field because they're effectively micromanaging, and when they do that, they're actually disrupting trust and accountability, which are two essential concepts to actually be able to have successful change?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I do workshops with leaders and I talk about moving from command and control to empowerment and trust. So, you know, and to me, whether you're leading, driving change, you're just a leader. I mean, everyone is driving change. You need to be clear on expectations, make sure that we're all on the same page, be there available to support when people need you, and then get out of the way and just let them get on with it. And, you know, you see, when I say that to some leadership workshops, they go, anarchy, you know. And I'm like, no, it's not. This is where magic happens. Start small. Find something that's low risk. Mm-hmm. Talk to your employees about that you are going to actually change your style of direction and management, because otherwise they'll think, you know, you've had a bang on the head. that you are going to try and empower them more. You realize that, and this is vulnerability coming in, that you realize that you should empower people more. So we're going to try this. And find something small, low risk that you feel more comfortable with, the employee feels comfortable with. Clear on your expectations. What's the outcome? When do you need it? Is there a budget? How many times are you going to check in? Agree mm-hmm. the frequency. Mm-hmm. But you are available in between times if needed. And then let them run. Yep. And magic happens. It really does. The leader has more time on their hands. And the person who's just been given the self-management is engaged, inspired, and will do a better job than they've probably ever done.
Mm-hmm.
Where what we need in that to stop the anarchy that they fear is what I call the guardrails, like on a road. They keep mm-hmm. us going off the road. And if I'm mm-hmm. bumping against that guardrail, I'm in trouble. So that's when I stop and say, boss, I'm hitting the guardrails. So we have principles that keep people. And those principles or guardrails can expand over time. They might be fairly tight initially because mm-hmm. that keeps the leader comfortable and the employee as well. And over time, you expand them and let people just get on with it. But absolutely no room for micromanagement. We don't have time. And what you said, Fatima, was absolutely true. If you are micromanaging, then what you are saying to people is, I do not trust you.
Yeah.
And that's devastating for an employee. I don't trust you. So I'm going to handhold you and tell you to do it my way.
Yes.
Every step of the way.
Or because I can do it better than you. Or I know, it's very silly. Don't be a leader if that's the case. Just do your own work. And
You're not a leader if you're doing that.
You need to lead by example. Lead by example with change. Lead by example in, how you see the culture of a team. Lead by example with mental health, like even speaking up about that, going back to that point earlier. So I think leading by example is the best thing that you can do. And if you're going to talk about change, or you're going to talk about going agile or being agile, whatever it is you're talking about, you need to lead by example. So I think that's a really positive takeaway, I guess, from that moment. Just to kind of round out around your sort of coaching and training experience, you've obviously done a lot of that, and it's one of the things you pretty much spend a lot of your time, other than writing 1,000 books, which I'll put some notes in the show notes around those books so people can get a copy of them. But what's been the most rewarding thing about your coaching that you've done, and has it always been met with positivity, or have you had some pushback sometimes?
Yeah, look, there's always doubters. Talking about command and control to empowerment and trust, for a lot of people, that's a major shift. And you'll see the not going to work here. The crossed mm-hmm. arms happen, But it's, and I think the greatest is when you turn those people around and you see the magic happen. And it's having those conversations about and getting them to feel comfortable. Look, how risky is it if we got little Johnny, who sits in the corner, to do this task, activity. Mm-hmm. We're not running a project. We're just doing something, and you let him do it his way, having made it clear what you expect, and and you make sure that he understands. How hard could that be?
Yep.
And eventually they go, okay. And they do it, and they go, that was really good. And they'll do more of it. And that's what I love, when the lights go on. Because often we talk about this, you need to stop micromanaging and do this. Well, that's a massive jump. You know, that's a chasm too far for a lot of people.
Yep.
Let's invite, let's climb the ladder a rung at a time. And when we get to the top, it's like, whoa, the picture's massive, you know. But yeah, that's the best bit, I think, about coaching and helping leaders is see the lights go on and see their teams be inspired by what's going on and seeing leaders really and themselves getting inspired and going, yeah, this is good. This is good. I can do this.
Yeah. And doing it incrementally, as you pointed out, it's not about a big bang. It's gone are the days, I think, of big bang transformation programs. It's all about incremental change.
Yeah. And it is for everybody. You know, it's like if I said to you, Fatima, I'm going to run the next marathon and I go out tomorrow and I run however many K a marathon is, you see how much I know. And I'm not going to do it. I'm going to go out and run a couple of K and I'll do that for a few weeks and then or whatever. I'll have a training plan. It's the same with any change. You know, we do it. It's an individual change. I'm going to do it gradually. So when I work with you, we do it in bite-sized pieces, what they're comfortable with. If they're going to, it doesn't mean getting outside the comfort zone. They have to. Mm-hmm. But it's how far you push someone until they get into the terror zone and you're never going to get them back. You know? Yeah. So it's bite-sized pieces that, and hearing what people are comfortable with and work. Yeah. Some people are happy to take, you know, to run up the ladder two rungs at a time. Some will be not. I'm going to take it a rung at a time. So we need to understand what people's comfort zone is. But yeah, all our development is incremental. It has to be. We take steps and we build on them.
Yeah, absolutely. As long as they're willing to try, you know, that's the least that we can ask. Just be willing to try. Just be open to it. And you never know what actually can result.
Exactly.
And it's interesting because one other thing that comes to mind when we're talking about this is I think it's Amazon's founder, Jeff Bezos, who talks about type 1 and type 2 decisions, where he says that, he focuses his energy on type 1 decisions that could significantly jeopardize the organization, whereas a type 2 decision is something that he delegates and allows other people in his team to make because it's not going to be the end of the world. So, again, it's just about not micromanaging. It's near impossible in an organization that size, let alone even in a small business. We try to stop doing that because you try to be across everything and do everything and then you don't do anything very well.
When I say to people, you know, if you think of a ship and I'm going, if you're shooting above the line, we're probably okay because we can fix it.
Yeah.
If you're shooting below the waterline, don't, because we'll probably sink the boat. That's the Jeff Bezos decision.
Yes.
Yes, the above the waterline, go for it. Let's see what happens, you know.
You recently published a series on YouTube called You're Going to Need a Bigger Boat. Was that the idea behind that series? Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
It was You're Going to Need a Bigger Boat. You're going to need to do, it was all about you're going to do need to do more things to get people through this, you know. So it was pulling on the line in the Jaws movie, we're going to need a bigger boat. But we're going to need to put more things into our leadership boat than we've ever had before. And that to really take the organization forward. So that was the essence of the series. We're going to need leading with compassion. We're going to need empathy. We're going to need communication and listening. It's all about the soft skills and the hard skills. And these are the things leaders need to put into their boat to stay afloat and get through the other side of this. Yes, they've had the good technologists or their good program managers, the good project managers, but they really need now to be able to inspire, like I say, get out the way. So there's more things they're going to need in the, what I call the boat, it could be the backpack, it could be the toolkit, whatever we want, analogy we want to use, but yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Karen. That's been really good. We're almost out of time. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners, a call to action, a piece of advice or a question to ponder?
Well, one of the things we mentioned, the Resiliator Handbooks at the moment on the front page of my website, karenferris.com, there's two free downloads of the first six chapters of both books. It does ask you to register, you know, quid pro quo. But go and have a look at that. There's other books there as well in the bookstore, as you say. I love writing. I'm a prolific writer. So just think that change is constant and how are you going to embrace it?
Beautiful. Thank you so much. We'll make sure we include links to your website and to the books as well. And obviously, I've got one of them. It's very good. So I think that people should get out there and register. And also, they can contact you if they need any help in their organization with your coaching services as well through your website.
Absolutely. Perfect. They can.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Karen. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that episode with Karen Ferris. You can contact Karen Ferris at her website. It's www.karenferris, that's ferris.com, or you can find her on Twitter at Karen_Ferris, that's ferris. Hopefully you've enjoyed that episode today. It is nearing the end of the year, so we will be taking a break soon. Though in the meantime, if you're feeling generous and you would like to do something positive in the world, we would welcome you to leave a podcast review if you've enjoyed this episode or any of our previous episodes. Thank you for listening to this podcast. We welcome any feedback. Please let us know by going to www.agilemanagementoffice.com/agileideas. You can also find us on most social media channels by searching Agile Ideas or follow me on LinkedIn. Thank you for listening. Please share or rate this if you enjoyed it. I hope you've been able to learn, feel, think, or be inspired today. Until next time, what's your Agile Idea?